Today is February the 7th, 2016, and this is a Sunday Dharma talk. When I thought about what topic to use, I was tempted to choose who knew and take the lives of four very significant Zen women who put a crack in the patriarchy, but that talk will wait for another day because I chose to focus more on staying on the path. Traditionally, members are invited to give coming to the path talks, and these are very inspiring and offer a great encouragement, but perhaps there is a place for talks about staying on the path, what it takes to stick with practice, whether one simply went to an introduction a couple of weeks ago, or whether one's practiced for 2, 3, 10, 20, 30, or 40 years. And we have those people, all of us in here, have been practicing for one of those numbers. So I'm going to read and comment on writings from two teachers who approach the path from very different angles, but as Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian teacher of this century, said, all the rivers of all the religions empty into the same sea. So we're really talking about one thing, but it's not two, but there are different ways of approaching practice, and they can all augment the other. One goes into the method and aspiration to awaken based on experience from a deeply enlightened state, which speaks to the last of the four vows that we recite every day, the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain, the wisdom element. The other teacher speaks to purity of heart, the ultimate expression of our true nature, which is to save all beings, and fulfills what is the first of the four vows, all beings without number I vow to liberate, compassion in action. Roshi often reminds us that wisdom and compassion are like the wings of a bird, and we need both wings in equal measure. And it's really easy in practice when we're going to Sashin and we're striving to get very inward and my practice, what I have to do, and we forget this vast ocean in which we appear. So the two teachers that I'm going to speak from, one is Gary Weber, his book Happiness Beyond Thought, and Tanisaro Bhikkhu, an article which he entitles Purity of Heart. So I'll give a short biography of Gary Weber first. And he says of himself, biographies and personal histories are of intense interest to others. It's not clear whether knowing this information is of any real value or if it just adds more confusion, but it arises so often that it's easier to include one. It's important to remember that a biography is only one version of the story, always remembered incorrectly and from a highly subjective standpoint. Recent brain studies have shown that the brain does modify long-term memories, perhaps because it gets too bored with them. All of these experiences happen to no one, and they ultimately mean nothing. The events and situations were created out of the control of an I and arose from nothingness and went into nothingness. An I was used as the subject here rather than the standard third-person approach like your mother wrote it, but both are equally incorrect. Attaching any importance, ownership, or personal causation to these chance remembrances is foolish. As one of my Zen teachers, Tony Packer, said frequently, whatever happens to you is none of your business. Or, as Rumi has said, your life is not your own. I was raised in a devout Methodist home and through early adolescence was involved in religious activities and even gained some religious talks. From early adolescence until late 20s, I lived a secular life with marriage, two children, undergraduate school, nuclear submarine service, and then graduate school. I did, however, at some deep level, even as a kid, know that despite much conventional Christian teaching to the contrary, that it was possible for everyone to experience the consciousness of which Jesus spoke. I don't know how I knew this, but I did. Just a comment here. There's nobody in this room who hasn't had that glimpse as a child of this other, the suchness. And I think that's why we keep going, and that's part of staying on the path. Following a near-death experience in the military, he was in a nuclear submarine, and it almost came to total disaster. I became intent on seeing if it was possible to gain an understanding that would somehow end my mental turmoil and confusion. I was also set on knowing the truth, which didn't look promising, as all I had known until then was certainly in question. I also burned to be enlightened, although I didn't really know what that meant. I read all of the Eastern spiritual and philosophical books I could find, and one day, while reading a book of Zen poetry that I happened upon, I read the first line of what I would later discover was a famous poem, "And the World Fell Away." I was in a space that was far beyond anything I had ever known. This was totally unexpected. I did not do drugs and had never heard of anything like this, and so was totally unprepared. Consequently, after something like an hour, the state passed. I was, however, left with a burning desire to return to whatever it was that had been there. I think many of us will resonate with that. You can have an experience and you just want to get back there because it was so intense and deep. So to continue, as this had been a Zen book, I went intensely into Zen meditation, and I then took up various yoga practices, at first so that I could sit longer, and then later to work with the body and breath. After finishing graduate school, I became a scientist at a national research lab, and then subsequently worked for over 25 years in a series of jobs in different industrial companies. To my great surprise, I eventually reached the level of senior vice president in a large company and oversaw about 1,000 employees and a $260 million budget. So, you know, practice can happen within this secular life. This is really important. You don't have to give up your life and, you know, join a training center. You can. This happens within our whatever life we end up with. To continue, whenever I could, I studied with different yoga and Zen teachers and Eastern philosophers and took workshop and teachers' training courses. As I had a family, the only real free time that was normally available for practice was early in the morning. I would get up several hours before work to meditate and do yoga. And I would also meditate in the evenings and read spiritual books when I got the chance. Several times I taught yoga and meditation courses, but ultimately stopped because I knew that I really didn't know the truth of spiritual practice. My children were raised, went off to college, we moved many times, etc. There were many spiritual experiences, but nothing that was lasting or that ended the turmoil and confusion of my thoughts. Somehow, I happened upon the teachings of Ramana Maharshi. I began looking in the other direction, back inside at what it was that was doing all of these practices and causing all this confusion. One day, realizing that enlightenment was impossible as long as there was an I insisting on being present for the exciting conclusion, as well as keeping all of its attachment, I surrendered completely. Everything was surrendered. Everything. Myself, possessions, job, corner, office, parking space, options, house, everything. I said deeply and sincerely from the bottom of my being that I had to know the truth, even if it cost my life. With that surrender, I could feel something shift. Shortly afterwards, doing an asana that I had done thousands of times before, the eye blew out like a candle in the wind, and a page turned. I went into the asana one way and came out, transformed. Consciousness shifted completely and irrevocably. Thought stopped as a continuous activity, and stillness and presence was there at a level I could never have imagined. I realized that I was not this body, nor these thoughts, but the undying consciousness behind them. I saw that everything was perfect just as it was, and that everything was somehow inside me and was in fact all one. Surprisingly, I also realized that everything was God. For several years, although others tried to convince me to begin teaching, I resisted, as it just didn't make any sense. Everyone and everything that I saw was me, and it made no sense to teach an imaginary me what I already knew. There was no teacher and no one to teach. Finally, at the urging of fellow travelers, yoga teachers, and a Zen master, I began teaching again. What is taught comes from nowhere, just as it arises, which makes class preparation really easy. Long way to go, Errol. It's a mystery how and why it all happens. A mystery. We'll come to Tanisara Bhikkhu when we read his little piece. So, why do people quit practice? Well, people quit practice maybe because they think they failed, they haven't come to awakening, they think it isn't working for them. Life overtakes, families, careers, success, illness, depression, addiction, unhappiness, physical limitations, all of the human samsaric things. Or we fail to understand the real nature of the process, of the training. This is a giving practice. It's not a getting practice. So I've been talking now about this failure to get something, failure to come to awakening. It's about uncovering our true nature, not attaining something. Gary says here, don't lose sight of the fact that enlightenment is about revealing that your real nature, your natural state, is stillness, happiness, and presence. It's not something you need to go out and manufacture or obtain. It's already there. All that you need to do is to get the clouds out of the way. I'm not sure we always equate Zen practice with being happy, but it really is the fundamental truth is that happiness is our natural state. The work we have to do is to be wearing away at the I, me, mine basis of living, which dominates the mind of most of human beings. And we know from current neuroscience that this I, me, mine thinking is our default mode. When we aren't attending to a specific task or concentrating, that's where we go. Gary calls this the blah, blah land. The problem is that when we're in the blah blah land, our task positive network, which is the access path to awareness, stillness, samadhi, and transcendence, shuts down. But when the blah blah network is on, the TPN network is off. And we're mostly unconscious of our blah blah network, and it's only when we gradually bring it into consciousness by making an effort and concentrating that we can start to recognize it. And it's the recognition itself, not doing anything with it, the consciousness of what is going on is the process of dismantling it. The brain is an amazing computer, but a self-centered operating system dooms us to unhappiness. If we come to be able to be conscious of our thoughts, we find we're either thinking about the past or the future, but rarely are we actually present in the now. And so often we're working almost unconsciously to be a somebody. will I be chosen? Am I good enough? Am I attractive enough? Am I whatever? This seeps in into our unawareness, actually. And actually, all of these self-referential thoughts include things like the emotions, embarrassment, self-consciousness, shame, envy, self-pity, introspection, aggrandizement. These are all lumped in under that I, me, mine thing, whatever it is. We tend to think that this training involves attainment, but in fact it involves becoming aware of this self-referential thinking and diminishing the hold it has over us. And from this we might gather that we're somehow erasing or rubbing out self-referential thinking, but this would be a great mistake. There's no rubbing out or forceful elimination, but effort is required to keep our attention in the present. If we don't make any effort, then it's easy to become distracted, and pretty much we drift off into blah blah and, you know, self-punishment thinking often. We can use the metaphor of a huge aquarium. That's our true nature. The water is our ever-present awareness. And the fish are our thoughts. Sometimes a single fish. Sometimes a shoal of fish. Sometimes a piranha. Sometimes an ugly fish. Unspeakable things. Man of war, jellyfish. They're all coming and going, but the water remains unchanged. And our practice is simply to notice the fish, not to judge them or define them or link them to our identity, but to let them swim on. To simply see what is the cure. The other discouragement or way people leave practice is you get discouraged or bored, or nothing seems to be happening. You work so hard and the practice seems so dry and shriveled up, you know. And then Gary says, you will see parts of your mind and thoughts that may surprise, disappoint, frighten, and depress, thoughts that you were never aware of before. Practice has not somehow mysteriously created them. They were there all along. With everything else out of the way, they now have a chance to manifest. With persistent inquiry, your thoughts will lose their strength and energy. They will trouble you less and less. With persistent practice, we bring the self-referential thoughts, I, me, my, into consciousness, and this is their undoing. They can only operate as long as they are subconscious. This is the great healing. So rather than despair over our mind chatter, somewhere when we can see it without rejecting it, we can be grateful for it. So really, noticing our mind chatter is to be the silent witness, and it's the first step in disengaging from our thought identity. It can take years before we even realize that we're not our thoughts, but they're not who we are. And mastering any skill requires repetition of the technique or method over many thousand hours. No one becomes a concert violinist practicing 1 hour a week. For a skill to become incorporated into the neurological system to change the brain so that it no longer requires effort takes around, well, according to research, around 10,000 hours of consistent, repetitive application. That's for most people, and typically involves a significant amount of suffering. Anyone who has children practicing will know it's not always fun to go and practice scales and you want to be doing something else and you're chained to your practice there. As we practice over time, seeing through and letting go of thoughts, the mind returns to its natural stillness and silence and ultimately reaches a state of non-dual awareness. You could say awakening, it's another word for it, which I think is the one Gary uses, non-dual awareness. And this is actually the basic testimony of our Zen faith. Then Gary says, letting go of thoughts is no mean task. In everyday life, our mind is filled with endless thoughts, roughly 60,000 every day. Memories of pains and pleasures, regrets of things we wish we hadn't done or wish we had, things we wish we had said or hadn't, things we will say or do in the future fill our days. Most of our days are filled with struggle, uncertainty, doubt, and confusion. We believe that without these thoughts, nothing can be accomplished, that we will be unhappy and unsuccessful in life, and even in danger for our very survival. We believe that we are our thoughts, and so do this thinking, 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 from when we wake up until we fall asleep, and even in our dreams. Unfortunately, this approach, as we all know, is unsuccessful. The stream of thoughts just doesn't deliver the happiness and peace we want. Pleasures are short-lived and never measure up to expectations, requiring more thoughts, greater effort, and more disappointments in the pursuit of the elusive, lasting happiness. Isn't there a better approach to happiness, one that would make it possible for us to live a sane and holistic life while fully engaged in the activities of today's world? What if you could dramatically slow and perhaps stop the constant stream of thoughts? What if you could live with only occasional thoughts in a heightened awareness that is fully alert, aware and functional, and yet calm, peaceful and happy? Thoughts will still be available for certain tasks, but they are now an instrument in the band, not the stressed out, confused solo singer and guitar. Mental tasks, when they occur, are done with greater insight, clarity, and perception, as they no longer have to fight their way through unending competing streams of thought. If you look at when you have had a unique insight, inspiration, or revelation, an aha moment of stillness and clarity, that is what you do in this work of meditation. It makes such occurrences more likely. In fact, it becomes your principal state of being. Without extensive reshaping of the neural patterns and functioning in the brain, the mechanics are not sufficiently patterned so that the transcendent and creativity and performance can emerge. Indeed, there are few skills that do not require functional mastery before reaching the level at which the activity can become so automatic that something extraordinary or transcendent can occur. This is the whole thing in a nutshell. This is what our practice does. Another Indian sage of this century said, to be free of thoughts is itself meditation. And you know, as we begin to wear away at the I, me, mine, the mind fights back in many subtle ways. And this is something that happens in practice. You suddenly get full of doubts and obstructions, and this is, if you're making any kind of progress, this ego, the I, me, mine operating system, doesn't give up its dominance willingly. The ego always appropriates every experience. And even awakening may also have a negative side to it and result in a new merit badge that people wear, you know. Or why? Maybe subtly go around saying, ha, I got it. But it's there. And it's one of the things to keep in mind when reading the three pillars of Zen, that we don't get so inspired by the awakening stories that we want that badge. The other aspect of practice that I think is very important, and Gary really is the first one I really we've really seen make a focus on it. As we begin to wear away the I, me, my, being in the body, this is another crucial aspect of practice. If you think about affirming faith in mind, this sense world is enlightenment. Got to be present. We have to use the body. We can't, you know, meditation, sitting on a cushion, the mind, the body still. We tend to just, it's not necessarily fully present in our body. We're not, every cell is not engaged. So this goes into mindfulness practice when walking, washing the dishes, all of these things is bringing the body into the practice. Weber recommends a consistent yoga practice, but Tai Chi, Qigong would work just as well. And he says most meditation practice do not incorporate a physical practice done with much understanding. Without this, there is little possibility of activating and addressing deeply held conditioning, memories or fears that may be locked in your physiological structure. This is a great opportunity missed, as the body knows on the cellular level the real truth that we are. Traditional yoga is normally practiced now in the West with its focus on achieving certain postures and bodily perfection, naturally leads to comparison and conflicts. In a typical course, an ad hoc practitioner of yoga is created who subsequently enhanced, measured, and critiqued. This does not lead to an enlightened heart. Now, this is not to condemn any particular form of yoga, but it is when we have a practice, maybe it's a flow, a series that we do, it's not about, am I getting there? It's the same kind of letting go of the I, me, mine part of it. Some people do body work and find it's enormously helpful. And just as Roshi often recommends, when people have psychological issues, buried things buried so deeply that you really can't look at them with any clarity or don't know what to do with them, so he recommends therapy. And I think we should also be recommending, you know, sometimes body work and even having some consistent practice that has its roots in long tradition and understanding, because these traditions all point to this same freedom. So now I'm going to switch to Chanisaru Bhikkhu. Chanisaru Bhikkhu is he's a Theravadan Buddhist monk in the Thai forest tradition. So Achan Cha, many people have read out of Achan Cha, and he's currently the abbot of the Metta Forest Monastery in San Diego, the first monastery established in the Thai forest tradition in the U.S. He co-founded the monastery with Achan Suwat Sumiko, and he's best known for his translation of the Dhammapada and the Pitaka Sutra. Like many Theravadins, there's a great deal of sutra study and looking into the Pali Canon and so forth. And he is a strong proponent of Buddhist ordination for women, and he's translated some really very wonderful awakening accounts of early Buddhist nuns. Here we go. Purity of heart. During my first weeks with my teacher, Achan Phuong, I began to realize that he had psychic powers. He never made a show of them, but I gradually sensed that he could read my mind and anticipate future events. I became intrigued. What else did he know? How did he know it? He must have detected where my thoughts were going, for one evening he gently headed me off. "You know," he said, "the whole aim of our practice is purity of heart. Everything else is just games." That one phrase, purity of heart, more than intrigued me. It reverberated deep down inside. Although I was extremely disillusioned with Christianity, I still valued Kierkegaard's dictum, purity of heart is to will one thing. I didn't agree with Kierkegaard as to what that one thing was, but I did agree that purity of the heart is the most important treasure of life. And here, Achan Phuong was offering to teach me how to develop it. That's one of the reasons why I stayed with him, for 22 years, until he died. His basic definition of purity of heart was simple enough: a happiness that will never harm anyone. But a happiness like that is hard to find, for ordinary happiness requires that we eat. As the first of the novice's questions says, "What is one? All beings subsist on food." This is how the Buddha introduced the topic of causality to young people. The primal causal relationship isn't something gentle like light reflecting off mirrors or jewels illuminating jewels. It's feeding. Our bodies need physical food for their well-being. Our minds need the food of pleasant sensory contacts, intentions, and consciousness itself in order to function. If you ever want proof that interconnectedness isn't always something to celebrate, just contemplate how the beings of the world feed on one another physically and emotionally. Interbeing is intereating. As Ajahn Suwat, my second teacher, once said, "If there were a God who could arrange that by my eating I could make everyone in the world full, I'd bow down to that God." But that's not how eating works. Ordinarily, even well-intentioned people may not see eating as harmful. We're so compelled to eat that we blind ourselves to its larger impact. Our first pleasure after the terror of being born was getting to feed. We did it with our eyes closed, and most people keep their eyes closed to the impact of their feeding throughout life. But when you go to a quiet, secluded place and start examining your life, you begin to see what enormous issue it is just to keep the body and mind well fed. On the one hand, you see the suffering you create for others simply in your need to feed. On the other, you see something even more dismaying: the emotions that arise within you when you don't feel that your body and mind are getting enough to eat. You realize that as long as your source of physical or mental food is unreliable, you're unreliable too. You see why even good people can reach a point where they're capable of murder, deceit, adultery, or theft. Being born with a body means that we're born with a huge bundle of needs that compels and can overwhelm our minds. Fortunately, we human beings have the potential to civilize our eating habits by learning to wean ourselves from our passion for the junk food of sights, sounds, smells, etc., and look instead for good food within. When we learn to appreciate the joy that comes from generosity, honor, compassion, and trust, we see that it's much more fulfilling than the pleasure that comes simply from grabbing what we can for ourselves. We realize that our happiness can't be independent of the happiness of others. We can give one another our belongings, our time, our love, ourselves, and see it not as a loss, but as a mutual gain. Unfortunately, these qualities of the heart are conditional, for they depend on a tender web of beliefs and feelings. Belief in justice and the basic goodness of human nature, feelings of trust and affection. When that web breaks, as it so easily can, the heart can turn vicious. We see this in divorce, broken families, and society at large, when the security of our food source, the basis of our mental and material well-being, gets threatened. The finer qualities of the mind can vanish. Think here of what's happening currently in Syria on Friday, the combined forces of Russia and Assad bombed the last road into Aleppo, which is then cut off once again from food, and people are starving. To continue, people who believe in kindness can suddenly seek revenge. Those who espouse nonviolence can suddenly call for war. And those who rule by divisiveness, by making a mockery of compassion, prudence, and our common humanity, find a willing following for their law of the jungle agenda. This is why compassion based only on belief or feeling is not enough to guarantee our behavior, and why the practice of training the mind to reach an unconditioned happiness is not a selfish thing. If you value compassion and trust, it's an imperative. For only an unconditioned happiness could guarantee the purity of your behavior. Independent of space and time, it's beyond alteration. No one can threaten its food source, for it has no need to feed. And when you've had even just a glimpse of this happiness, your belief in goodness becomes unshakable. That way, other people can totally trust you, and you can genuinely trust yourself. You lack for nothing. Purity of heart is to know this one thing. There can be no better reason for staying on the path. Well, that's it. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer them or refer them to someone who has a deeper understanding of this, whatever it is.